Well, thanks for that introduction, Martin, and thanks for inviting me along here to speak this morning. In fact, it's the only time when I've looked at a program and seen that I've got 4 hour slot ahead of me, so I'm either going to have to talk incredibly slowly or else you're going to have to ask lots of questions as I go along. But really, I'm very happy to be interrupted. I know it's quite a diverse sort of background of people in the audience, so please feel free to stop me and ask questions if you wish as we go through. Okay, well, this is really the starting point for, I guess, what many of us are going to have to say on the biology side in these sessions over the next few days. This idea that this huge family of receptors all sharing some elements of structure, talking through this other family of proteins to an enzyme, phospholipase C, that leads to the production of this intracellular messenger, IP3, and these receptors then, through this signaling pathway, lead to changed calcium fluxes at two different sets of membranes. Through IP3, they lead to a release of calcium from the intracellular stores, which for the most part are within the endoplasmic reticulum, through an IP3-gated calcium channel here in the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum. And these same receptors that lead to the formation of IP3 lead also to the opening of channels in the plasma membrane that surrounds the cells, allowing calcium to flow into the cell across the membrane that surrounds it. And what I'd like to do in the talk today is to begin talking mostly about this protein, the IP3 receptor in the ER, and to begin talking about some published work on how that receptor is regulated, and then move on after that to look a little bit at the structure of that protein, the IP3 receptor. And then further, perhaps the larger part of my talk, the second part of my talk, look up here at how these receptors communicate with these other channels in the plasma membrane to stimulate calcium entry across the plasma membrane. So that's the sort of agenda for my talk, really. So IP3 receptors first, these channels in the ER membrane, and I think it's fair to say that all animal cells express these proteins, these IP3 receptors. There are three genes in mammals that encode them, three distinct proteins, and some splice variants of them as well, and there are all sorts of subtle differences between them. But I think much more striking than the differences between these proteins are the shared properties of them. And the shared properties are that they all form these tetrameric assemblies in their native state, so always they're assembled into these tetramers. They're all gated by IP3, and Dan, I'm sure, will have something to say in his talk about other things that may also gate them. And they all form these intracellular calcium channels, IP3-gated calcium channels. So they're the shared properties. And another property that I think it's probably now fair to say is shared by all of them is that not only do they gate calcium and allow calcium to flow through the channel, but all of these receptors are also regulated by the calcium that flows through them. And of course, that's a very important feature that plays a major part in all sorts of models about how one calcium channel may talk to another. And the typical sort of way in which people had looked at this led to these sorts of observations where cells have been, permeabilized cells, have been incubated with different sorts of free calcium concentrations here spanning the physiological range. And the typical sort of response that we've seen from cells expressing each of the three mammalian subtypes of IP3 receptor is this biphasic dependence on cytosolic calcium concentration. So that modest increases in cytosolic calcium concentration potentiate the effects of IP3, and higher concentrations are inhibitory. So inhibitory, in fact, that they can completely shut down the IP3 receptor at concentrations of calcium that still lie well within the sort of physiological range of concentrations that you might expect to find somewhere near these open channels. Between the three IP3 receptor subtypes. There are some differences, and there have been claims that the type 3 is not inhibited by cytosolic calcium at all. I think that's really a rather contentious claim now, probably arising from the fact that most of the evidence upon which that was based was done in bilayers, where quite possibly a protein that's responsible to mediate the inhibition has been lost on the way to the bilayer. Because I think most people, when they've looked in more native settings, us and other groups in permeabilized cells, and Dan and Kevin Foskin's group in patch clamp work have found that the type 3 receptor in those settings is inhibited too. So there may be some subtle variations in the sensitivity to IP3 and in the calcium sensitivity, but I think this basic pattern is probably, to my mind, is a feature of all three subtypes.
Could you explain how the abscess and the ordinate are determined? Is the ordinate the calcium that goes through the?
Yeah, this is really more a cartoon than that. These are all shifted with regard to each other, just to show that the pattern is the same. Yeah, this is just showing how much calcium would be released from the ER, so how much would enter the cytosol.
Depending on
the free concentration of calcium in the cytosol.
Somewhere in the cytosol. I mean, in other words.
If I could show you how we do the experiments in the next slide, and then if that's still not clear, it might. I can come back to it. So really, we're interested in understanding how this biphasic regulation is exercised, and the way in which we have done that, and many other groups too, is to take this sort of approach. It's isolated hepatocytes that we've mostly used, but the method applies equally well to others. So you start with an intact cell here, with all its organelles trapped within the intact plasma membrane, and then we can permeabilize that plasma membrane selectively with a detergent that interacts with cholesterol that's in the plasma membrane but not within the intracellular organelles. So now we end up with a cytosolic space that's continuous with the medium that we're incubating the cells in, but the organelles are still intact. And in those conditions, we can manipulate what the environment is that surrounds those intracellular organelles and buffer the free calcium at whatever level we wish, and that's what was shown in that previous slide. And then we can add ATP and 45 calcium so that we can reload the intracellular stores with 45 calcium. The ATP, of course, that the cell normally makes is now leaked out through the hole, so we have to give it back again. And now we can add exogenous IP3, which normally would be trapped within the cell, but now with those holes punched in the plasma membrane can gain free access to the intracellular stores. And that's the sort of system that we'd used in that earlier setting that I'd shown. But to try and get rather better temporal resolution than those sorts of assays that I'd shown are capable of, we developed, or at least Jonathan Marchant, when he was in my lab, developed a rapid superfusion system where we take these cells that we've permeabilized and loaded with 45 calcium and then trap them on a set of filters here that just immobilize them within this tiny little stainless steel chamber. And this is a chamber that has a volume of only about 60 microliters, so the cells are now trapped within that filter. And then we can superfuse medium through that filter at a very high rate, about 2 mL/s, so we can get very rapid turnover of the medium within here. And we can control exactly which medium it is that's flowing through and around the cells just by this computer-controlled valve assembly. So we have medium that reasonably resembles cytosol now flowing at high rates through these cells, and then we can collect the 45 calcium that's released from them in this programmable circular turntable that just runs below it, and so measure the 45 calcium released from the cells. And we can record exactly when it is that whatever thing it is we're stimulating the cells with arrives by including within here another radioactive marker, tritiated inulin, which we can distinguish from the calcium when we come to count the samples. And so that records for us exactly when the changed medium hit the cells, and then we can relate the arrival of the medium to the release of calcium from the cells. And with this, we can get down to temporal resolutions, as I'll show you in a moment, of about 9 milliseconds. And this just shows you that a rather lesser temporal resolution recording. Here's the IP3 arriving, marked out by the arrival of this tritiated inulin in the vials collected at the bottom here. And here's the 45 calcium that's been released from the cells, the IP3 stimulating the opening of that channel and allowing calcium to leak from the ER.
It's an experiment where calcium is clamped in the fibroblast.
That's right. And in fact, we see exactly the same phenomenon even if we clamp it with a very high concentration of BAPTA, 10 millimolar BAPTA. So we're doing our damnedest to try and eliminate any possibility of calcium feedback during the superfusion protocols. Now, if we just take this peak rate of 45 calcium release, which is our best index of the number of open IP3 receptor channels, and plot that out now against the concentration of IP3 that we're stimulating the cells with, we get our dose response curve, and it's a steep dose response curve with a Hill coefficient of around 3, telling us that well, the easiest interpretation of that is that three, or more likely all four, of the four subunits of this tetrameric IP3 receptor must bind IP3 before the channel can open and allow that calcium to leak out of the ER. I think it becomes very difficult when you're relying just on Hill coefficients to truly distinguish 2 versus 3 versus 4, because the tiniest shift in a dose response curve will take you from a Hill coefficient of, you know, of 2.7 to 3.3. I think that it's positively cooperative. I think would be rock solid to start using this to really nail down the exact number of sites that must be occupied. I think it's getting a little more shaky. This one actually was done with 1 millimolar BAPTA, but we did exactly the same experiment with 10 millimolar BAPTA, which shifts the dose response curve to the right, because BAPTA is actually a competitive antagonist of IP3, but the cooperativity was exactly the same. So we get the same Hill coefficient whether we use 1 millimolar BAPTA, which is what we routinely use, or 10 millimolar. We don't use 10 millimolar routinely simply because we then have to use 10 times as much IP3 to do the experiments, and that's astonishingly expensive because of this competitive antagonism.
Yeah? Just one more question.
Sure.
The axis on the ordinate axis on the upper diagram measure.
Yes.
That's a flux.
Yes, that's a flux. That's the percentage of calcium trapped within the stores being released per second. Okay, so that's our first observation, that we believe that more than one, several of the IP3 binding sites must be occupied by IP3 for the channel to open. If we come in now, though, and look with much higher resolution, those records were collecting the 45 calcium release at about 80 or 90 millisecond intervals. If we come in now and go as fast as we're capable of, which is to collect the 45 calcium at 9 millisecond intervals, then what we've done here, if we just look at the middle trace for the moment, on each of these traces, the filled circles just denote the arrival of the IP3 hitting the cells through that use of an inert tritiated inulin marker. So what we're doing here is finishing up with a final concentration of 100 micromolar IP3. We can't change it instantly because there's a mixing time as it goes through the chamber, and you see the mixing time there. It has a half time for mixing of about 30 milliseconds. But nonetheless, you can see that even though we're getting to about 100 micromolar final, there's this latency of about 30 or 40 milliseconds before we detect any 45 calcium release from the cells. Now, if I just go back to the previous slide, you'll see this dose response curve. We've got to the top of the curve here at about 10 micromolar IP3. That's enough to saturate the receptor, such that at this, we're up at 10 micromolar already here within the first few milliseconds of stimulating with the IP3. And yet, it's another 30 milliseconds before that channel opens, which is quite a long time in the lifespan of a channel to sit around idly for 30 milliseconds before it opens. The bottom panel, perhaps I should have mentioned the top one first. This is just a stimulation with a much lower concentration of IP3, 1 micromolar final, and perhaps it's no surprise that there's a long latency there. I've said you need to occupy multiple IP3 binding sites, and that's presumably just reflecting the time it takes for that low concentration to lead to occupancy of the multiple binding sites. It's the latency with these higher concentrations that's more interesting. Sure. Within the chamber, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, we did a number of controls to try and address that. Perhaps the most persuasive of them is that we took synaptosomes from Torpedo and looked at the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor and did exactly analogous experiments there with acetylcholine, and that opens with no detectable latency. There are other controls for that, but perhaps the most persuasive will just come with the next experiment that takes care of that, I think. If not, I can come back and describe the other experiments we've done. So here then we have a latency of about 30 milliseconds between reaching what we would assumed to be a maximal concentration of IP3 and before the channel opens. We can go even to much higher concentrations, incredibly expensive concentrations of IP3, 300 micromolar here, such that now we're at about 50 micromolar IP3 within the first 9 milliseconds, and still we have this latency of about 30 milliseconds before the channel opens. So there seems to be then a... Sorry, this is the concentration of IP3 up here. So this is reporting the calcium release. This is the concentration of IP3. Yeah. So there seems then to be a delay of about 30 milliseconds that cannot be shortened further by increasing the concentration of IP3, an irreducible delay. So what's going on in that 30 milliseconds when one would suppose the IP3 receptor has become fully liganded by IP3 and yet still doesn't seem to open? And the clue as to what may be going on comes here. Here's the data I've been showing you so far. Here's the IP3 arriving, and this is all now with supramaximal concentrations of IP3. Here's our 30 or 40 millisecond delay when we perform the experiments in a medium that sort of resembles normal resting cytosolic calcium concentrations of about 200 nanomolar. If we drop the cytosolic calcium concentration down to about 4 or 5 nanomolar, that latency runs out now to 90 milliseconds or so. And if we up the calcium concentration to close to a micromolar or higher still, then we reduce that latency and eventually abolish it. And perhaps that answers your question, Jim, that we can get immediate opening of the channel under certain conditions. So a latency that was irreducible by increasing the IP3 concentration can be abolished if we sufficiently increase the calcium concentration.
The concentration on the left is the calcium
concentration? Down here. Yeah?
It's the calcium
concentration buffered in the cytosol-like medium that we're perfusing with. Yeah. And these latencies don't change if we pre-incubate with the various concentrations of calcium. So the only interpretation we could place upon that, maybe others have, have alternative suggestions, we've not come up with anything else, was that we had a sequential binding of IP3 and then calcium before the channel could open, such that we give IP3, and that IP3 then leads to the disclosure of a calcium binding site to which calcium must bind before the channel could open. Indeed, we'd suppose it probably has to happen to all four of the subunits of the receptor before the channel can open. So that with the high concentrations of IP3, as I showed you earlier, we can move ourselves more quickly through this set of steps and get the receptor liganded more quickly, but then we're left waiting for the on rate of calcium to drive the channel opening, such that once you get to here, the only way you can further accelerate the rate of channel opening is to up the cytosolic calcium concentration to drive calcium onto this newly disclosed site more quickly and then lead to the channel opening, hence that shortening of the latency when we up the cytosolic calcium concentration. So that's what we think is going on when the channel activates. Because it doesn't matter how long we pre-incubate with the calcium, we can't shorten the latency any more than giving it at the same time as we give the IP3. IP3 seems to set the clock as to what the latency will be. So if I come now to the other effect of calcium on the IP3 receptor, this inhibitory effect of calcium on the IP3 receptor, that other side of this biphasic effect of cytosolic calcium. These are just a few kind of preliminary observations that we need to make sense of what comes later. Still superfusion measurements, and what we're doing now is treating the cells with a high cytosolic calcium concentration. We're out here treating the cells with various concentrations of cytosolic calcium concentration up to about 100 micromolar to try and mimic what might happen in the mouth of an open IP3 receptor, and then stimulating with IP3 and looking for the calcium release that we get. And these just show, here's our control trace, and here a trace is pre-treated for various periods with this 100 micromolar cytosolic calcium before we deliver the IP3. So high calcium first, then the IP3 in the continued presence of the high calcium. And that's just summarized here, where you see the pre-treatment with this high calcium causes a rapid and total inhibition of the subsequent ability of IP3 to cause calcium release, and that has a half-time for onset of somewhere around 50, 60 milliseconds. And that's not really so relevant, the calcium dependence of that phenomenon. The reversal of that effect is more slow, in that now if we allow the inhibition to develop and then wash out the calcium to take us back to the 200 nanomolar in which the IP3 receptor normally works, and then challenge with IP3, then we can track the rate of recovery, and that follows a much slower time course than that inhibition. So the important point from this really is that pre-incubation with high calcium will very rapidly completely attenuate the ability of IP3 to bring about a calcium release. And it doesn't matter how high you go with the IP3, you can go to super maximal concentrations and it's still ineffective. It's not simply a decrease in the affinity of the IP3 receptor for IP3.
How long does it take to recover completely?
In the hepatocytes, we've never had complete recovery, but there's an added complexity that there's an unusual form of calcium-induced calcium release in these cells, which I've not discussed at all here, that tends to lead to some loss of calcium from the stores, quite independent of the IP3 receptor, and that makes it more complicated in hepatocytes. In other cells, we have got complete reversal, where also it is slow. It's still slow, yeah. I can't remember whether it's exactly the same time scale, but it's a seconds time scale, just like it is in the hepatocytes.
So there's a different...
We don't know what that is, and another group has subsequently examined that as well and found this similar phenomenon, but we have no idea what it is that the protein that may mediate that. It's not the IP3 receptor. But you've certainly seen the other phenomenon of what looks like this requirement for of IP3 and then calcium binding. I think some of your Xenopus work would certainly have sat very comfortably with that idea. And
we see a delay, which one can actually...
Yeah, sure.
Using
yeah.
Calcium,
yeah.
Yeah.
Calcium. Right. Which would say we were aware of your work when we were doing this. There may be.
And I wonder if you have any clue as to whether that's because there's two populations of African
We we've really not looked at it closely enough because of this other problem with this unknown CICR. So I really wouldn't wish to read too much into that. It's not something we've specifically focused on. But the key experiment really was this one, where we tried to do what we thought would normally happen in the cell. That is, all the experiments I've talked about so far, we pre-incubate with high calcium and then the IP3. But I suppose if a receptor is releasing calcium, what would really happen is that it would get the IP3 first, it would open, and then it would find itself awash with a local high cytosolic calcium concentration. So we tried to repeat that sequence in the rapid superfusion. And what we've got here is our normal in the black lines just shows the normal response to IP3 and the normal resting cytosolic calcium concentration. But the red line shows what happens when, as soon as we get the IP3 evoked calcium release underway, we step to this 100 micromolar cytosolic calcium concentration, and we do that in a way that allows it to be almost a step-like increase in cytosolic calcium concentration. And remember, if we did that before we added IP3, it only took 50 milliseconds to get us the half inhibition, whereas what we see now is absolutely no inhibition over this 3-second time course of the IP3 evoked calcium release when we're giving the calcium after the IP3. Indeed, there's a bit of stimulation, and that's a reproducible stimulation, that stepping that calcium up actually gives a slightly more calcium release. What we think may be happening here is that that's just a reflection of some of the IP3 receptors still sitting around with IP3 on them, but not yet having picked up the stimulatory calcium that they need to open, and suddenly now they're awash with calcium and those sites can be occupied and the channel opens. But perhaps the more important point is that once these receptors have bound IP3, they don't seem any longer to be inhibited by the increase in cytosolic calcium that was so effective when it was delivered before they'd bound IP3.
So it's just for clarity, the dashed line is the external calcium. The dashed line is the external calcium, and the solid red line is the calcium flux.
No, this dashed line here is again our inulin marker, and we've added it with a lower amount of inulin in with the IP3, and then much more inulin when we step to the high calcium, so we can use the inulin to report the arrival of both stimuli. So this dashed line shows IP3 coming in, and then shows the high calcium coming in. We've only got one marker we can use for that, so we have to use it.
Right, but it's a proxy for calcium coming.
At this bit, it's a proxy for IP3 arriving, and where it takes off here, it's a proxy for the high calcium arriving.
Right, and the solid line is flux.
Both solid lines are flux, so this is release of calcium. Here, under control conditions where we don't increase the calcium, it's just the IP3, and the red under the conditions where this further break in the line has seen the step into high calcium. So that. Sorry, Mark.
Including from the gap between the red and black line, that there's no inhibition.
Yes.
One could say at the moment where calcium arrives, the slope of the red line becomes
slightly faster.
This
is not actually, there's a reason for that too, which and the way I've plotted it on this, these are plotted as percent per second rather than as fractional release rates. That would not show up if we plotted it as a fractional release rate. But of course, because these are finite calcium stores, as they lose calcium, then the amount that is still available to be lost in the next moment is decreasing. So we normally plot them, I'm not quite sure why we didn't on this one, plot them as fractional release rates to try and take account of that, and we haven't on this one. So what we've proposed from this then is that once an IP3 receptor has bound IP3, it can no longer be inhibited by cytosolic calcium that is capable of inhibiting an unliganded IP3 receptor. And we referred to this as lateral inhibition, and really that's to bring out a couple of points, one of which will come out later. Firstly, that calcium spewing out of a receptor is going to be capable of inhibiting its inactive neighbors, but it won't be capable of shutting down itself, at least not until IP3 has dissociated from it, would be our suggestion. And as we'll see, this term of lateral inhibition, I think, also brings out some parallels with the way in which lateral inhibition is thought to operate in the nervous system as a means of enhancing the signal-to-noise ratio. I'll come to that in just a second. So that leads us to this sort of scheme of what we think might control the IP3 receptor. We're suggesting there are two calcium binding sites associated with the IP3 receptor, and we still don't know where they are. They may be on the IP3 receptor itself, or they may be on accessory proteins that associate with the IP3 receptor. I guess most betting at the moment would probably say that this one resides on the IP3 receptor, and perhaps that one is an accessory protein, but that's still debated. Whatever, for cartoon purposes, I just show them as associated with the receptor. And in the resting state, we'd suggest that this inhibitory calcium binding site is free to bind calcium. The stimulatory site is somehow occluded. So that now, if in that resting state with no IP3, the calcium concentration is increased, it can jump into this inhibitory calcium binding site and lead to inhibition of the IP3 receptor so that IP3 can no longer gate it. If we give IP3, then that has this effect of both opening the stimulatory calcium binding site, the first set of experiments that I described to you, and of closing the inhibitory calcium binding site, the latter set of experiments that I just described, so that now calcium can jump into the stimulatory calcium binding site, and again, supposing that's happened to all four subunits, lead to the opening of the IP3 receptor. So that's the scheme that we'd propose, that really the role of IP3 in this setting is to set the scene to govern what calcium will then do to the gating of the channel. The real regulator of gating of the channel is calcium. The role of IP3 is to control what calcium is going to be allowed to do to the IP3 receptor. So we've tried really to sort of speculate as to what this might mean in terms of the sorts of calcium signals that Ian, for example, has recorded in Xenopus oocytes, and this is Ian's terminology too for these calcium release events that he's recorded from Xenopus oocytes, where many of you will know that at very low stimulus intensities, he's seen these very small localized calcium release events, calcium blips as they've been called, which might correspond to the opening of perhaps even a single IP3 receptor, or certainly no more than very few IP3 receptors. At higher concentrations of IP3, he sees these calcium puffs, which are the near synchronous opening of a larger number of IP3 receptors, I don't know, half a dozen or so IP3 receptors opening together to give bigger calcium signals. And then as we move further up the stimulus intensity range again, then these calcium puffs are occurring sufficiently frequently that the calcium diffusing from one calcium puff can ignite the neighboring activity of a neighboring cluster of IP3 receptors to lead to this regenerative propagation of a calcium wave or calcium spirals, the sort of things that that Jim reported many, many, many years ago. So I'd just like to see how it is that we might graft into this our notions of how IP3 and calcium work together to regulate the IP3 receptor. So we just start up there with our little cluster of IP3 receptors with no IP3 bound to them. And then we come along with a low concentration of IP3, and one of the receptors just happens to be the first one to get all the IP3 it needs and to then have its calcium stimulatory sites binding the calcium that it requires to open. And that channel now opens, but of course in opening, it will also release the calcium that will, because of the low concentration of IP3, and so the fact that most of its neighbors won't have IP3 bound, will create this annulus of inhibition around the active IP3 receptor. Ian. That's a great question. The answer to it governs whether the scheme can work or not, and we simply don't know. But you're absolutely right. If we need four IP3s to be bound to this, to bring this channel into play, then it's very likely that all of the neighbors, from sheer mass action, most of the neighbors are going to have at least one IP3 bound. And if one is enough to protect, it won't work. And we just don't know the answer. It's tricky to try and get at. If you've got any ideas as to how we get to it, I welcome them. But you're right, it absolutely hangs on just what the stoichiometry within these tetrameric channels are in terms of activation and protection. I wish I knew, because it's flawed if one will protect. So with that proviso, which you know has exercised us a great deal, we very much would like to know exactly how many IP3s need to be bound to a channel to protect it from calcium, exactly how many need to bind calcium to lead to activation, and so on, because the model really hangs upon exactly how those numbers come out. But not accepting that for a moment, that still then we have this effective, this active repression of your neighbors, which I think is really analogous to spare receptors in the plasma membrane, except it's rather more actively managed, in that we have lots of IP3 receptors, all capable of responding to IP3, so increasing your sensitivity, but this active repression of the ones that don't happen to get to the starting gate first means you don't immediately roll into rampant, uncontrolled amplification. So it's a way, I think, of giving you increased sensitivity to IP3. Now, as we move up the IP3 concentration curve, then it becomes more likely that some of your neighbors, again, are unliganded, so they'll be inhibited when the first channel goes, just like they were, and we'll get another annulus of inhibition. But a few of them now will have enough IP3 bound that all they're waiting for is the stimulatory calcium to occupy their IP3 binding site, so that now when the first channel goes, that calcium can jump into the the exposed calcium stimulatory binding sites of those primed IP3 receptors and very rapidly bring them into play, but again in a controlled, non-explosive fashion. Ian, are you? Okay, so that would be one way we try and work this in. But I say the absolutely crucial thing is exactly what the stoichiometry needs to be within a subunit, and we don't know that. I wish we had a way into it. We tried hard and
there's enough shotguns to, and then if you have the diffuses, it's IP3 diffuses
itself, right? Right. No, IP3 is.
Is very
yes. So
when the diffuses wait, or if there's something coming back, so it's just shotguns. So it picks up once in a while and accidentally have three IP3 sitting on the receptor.
That's what we're suggesting, that it's simply a stochastic thing. Yes. Yes.
And between clusters.
Yes.
Because otherwise, if you get a single one opening, the outside edges of that cluster will be activated instead of inhibited because the concentration will be too low. And on the other hand, you have to have the clusters far enough apart from each other so you can get something that looks like a pop. Otherwise, the calcium will be high enough.
These may be issues that we perhaps come back to more productively when we've heard Ian or other modeling talks as well, where people who've measured those look more directly at those things than we have.
When people looked at the sensitivity of calcium release between neurons, it is very insensitive, like the three require a lot more stimulation than other cells.
Sure.
And this has been ascribed to higher levels of calcium or calcium binding, but due to their high density
IP3 receptors in those cells, this could be very prevalent in the cell types. If you have very large, if the IP3 receptors are very close together, then you're going to get more inhibition from releasing singles. I mean, there have been a number of explanations for why Purkinje cells are so insensitive. The surprise is that here's the cell that expresses IP3 receptors at greater, higher levels than any other known cell type, and yet equally is about the least sensitive to IP3. I hadn't thought of that as an explanation, but it does sound another plausible explanation. The other thing that's been put forward is there's simply so much IP3 buffering in those cells that effectively you're trying to deliver IP3 against a big background of IP3 buffering. But
when you overexpress IP3 receptors in cells, those cells are not less sensitive to IP3. If you overexpress
them. They're often not conspicuously more sensitive either, though.
No.
Which is equally surprising. So in a sense that's a difficult one to bring to bear on it. Okay, well I want to leave that regulation of the IP3 receptors there. Gosh, at this rate I'm on target for the 4 hours. and turn instead briefly to the structural analysis, and I just want to talk about this very, very briefly. This is a collaboration that we've been involved with for a couple of years now with a group at Imperial, where we're using high-resolution EM analysis of purified IP3 receptors to reconstruct a structure for the IP3 receptor. And we've got it down to about 30 angstroms at the minute. But the problem when you're dealing with these relatively low-resolution pictures, where you certainly can't begin yet to see amino acid residues, is to try and understand how this sort of nice, pretty picture of the IP3 receptor with the channel domain out here, here's the ER membrane, we think, and this four-fold symmetric structure extending here 10 or 11 nanometers out into the cytosol. The problem one faces with these low-resolution pretty pictures is to try and understand which bits of the primary sequence map onto which bits of the pretty picture. You can't see the residue, so you've got to do it by some less direct means.
Are these sitting in the membrane?
These are not. These are in detergent and then on a microscope grid. So I just want to show one, I mean we're trying various other ways now to try and establish that, but I just want to show one trick that we've used to try and do it. And the trick has been to use these dimers of IP3, really like molecular rulers. So you make, and this is a collaboration with Barry Potter in Bath, you make a molecule of with it has an IP3 on either end of it, a bidentate ligand, and then you just vary the length of this polyethylene glycol chain that links these two ends of the IP3, these two IP3s together. And we've done this by modifying the two position here of IP3, which from a lot of earlier structure activity work we'd done, we knew IP3 receptors were very tolerant of even large changes to this two position. There are some things you simply can't touch on IP3 without screwing up its ability to interact with the IP3 receptor, but this position is probably the most tolerant of all. So the argument is that if we start with our tetrameric IP3 receptor up there and let one of these IP3s bind to the IP3 binding site, then the neighboring IP3 is also, of course, free to bind to a binding site, but now it's tethered by virtue of its having bound to the first site. So one ends up with a local, very, very high concentration of IP3 by virtue of this tethering of the second of the IP3s. Of course, if we make the chain too short, then it would be too short to extend far enough to reach a second IP3 binding site. And if we make the chain too long, then the effective concentration around neighboring IP3 binding sites is nowhere near as increased as it would be with when the spacing's about right. So the expectation is that if you make these dimeric IP3s, you're going to find an optimal length that gives you some insight into what the separation is of the IP3 binding sites on the receptor. And we see that reflected in an increased affinity of these dimeric IP3s when we get the separation about right.
This is just two molecules.
Yeah, this is...
Here, it's just different positions.
Here? All I've tried to represent here is just two molecules of IP3 tied together by a piece of string, basically.
And these are different positions over time?
Yeah, so that they're just freely moving around. And of course, the longer you make it, the more space it has to move around in, and the lower the effective increase in concentration. So again, I'll go through this fairly quickly. This just shows results from hepatocytes, functional assays at the top, radioligand binding at the bottom. Here's the effect of IP3, and here the effect of one of our shorter dimers of IP3. You see that it's more potent, and likewise it shows higher affinity in binding assays. The important result really is here, where we just plot out the average separation of the two IP3 molecules from each other as a function of how potent they are relative to IP3. And you see that when we get down to about a couple of nanometers, we get this improved affinity of the dimer for the IP3 receptor.
So the concentration in the upper left picture is IP3 or IP3 dimer?
It's IP3 plotted as if it had one IP3 binding site.
Okay, so half the concentration is the concentration of dimers.
No, we've plotted the dimer as a molar concentration as well. So there are actually two IP3 binding sites within that.
So it's one order.
It's about fivefold, four to fivefold. But the longer dimers are about equipotent with IP3. And I'll show you some... Sorry, Ian.
So could you use the dimer as a trick to get at that question of the cooperativity or the protection? The dimer would give you predominantly a double...
Yeah, that's a great... We've never had it in sufficient quantities to do the rapid superfusion, but that would be attainable. In terms of superfusion, you know, it's just like burning 5-pound notes, because you're just flowing this stuff through at 2 mL/s, and it's precious on stuff we have to that we have to collaborate to have. But that would be a great experiment, actually. I hadn't thought of it. Yeah. So that's liver cerebellum, which for technical reasons we had also to do, because we could only do the molecular manipulations on the type 1 IP3 receptor. It gives the same story. Here's IP3, here's the dimeric IP3 in a binding assay, and here's the preference of these sort of 1.5 to 2 nanometer dimers for the improved affinity. If you notice, actually, the longer ones also give an increased affinity on the cerebellum. I won't go into that, but I think actually that's a cross-linking between IP3 receptor tetramers in the cerebellum where they are expressed at a very high density relative to other tissues. We've got the evidence for that, but I won't go into it today. Now, of course, the other prediction of this is that if this increased binding of IP3 really is a consequence of its spanning the two IP3 binding sites, then we would expect to see no improvement in affinity if we could make a monomeric subunit of the IP3 receptor and then examine its binding. And that's exactly what we see. We've expressed as a bacterial fusion protein the IP3 binding domain of the type 1 IP3 receptor, and then looked at the binding of IP3 to it, and the two curves sit on top of each other there. So the dimeric and the monomeric IP3 now have the same affinity. So it looks like then this ability to show this increased affinity is a function of needing the tetrameric IP3 receptor. So that leads us to the conclusion that this distance here between the two IP3 binding sites on the IP3 receptor is somewhere around 2 nanometers. There's a qualification around that, and that the peg that one gets to make these dimers is a polydispersed compound. There is some variability in its length. It's not a perfect molecular caliper, so there's always an error bar associated with that. And that takes us back to the structure that we had, where others had suggested the IP3 binding sites resided right out here, and there are some criticisms as to how they arrived at that conclusion. Our suggestion would be that they're more likely to lie within this inner part of the IP3 receptor, because that's really about the only part where we could put two IP3 binding sites close enough to each other to give us this 2 or 3 nanometer separation, and yet still preserve a fourfold symmetry of the structure. Well, that was the short part of the talk. I'll start. I mean, I think it's much better to have the interruptions, but I'll.
There was a subject in the other way.
Right. I mean, the purpose of this workshop is actually to go on.
Sure.
If they go very through the talk, so one possibility is to take a short break, get a little bit of a song or something, and come back.
Before you go on, can I have one last question about those distances?
Sure.
Go back to that one where you had the one in the right there.
This one?
No.
Which, this one?
That one there.
Yeah.
The one there appears to be a single, like tetramer. It's a 2 nanometers. You've got the number 2 there, so you think that's the 8 nanometers?
Yeah, but the longer you get with the peg, the less confident you become of what length you can put on it. A, because it stretches, the molecule is stretching, and also because the polydispersed nature of the peg, the diversity in the lengths of the peg becomes more of a problem the longer they become. So although that was about 8 nanometers, the error bar associated with that 8 is much greater on the 8 than it is down on the 2.
The question I was going to ask is, if you look at gap junctions.
Yes. Well, in a sense, one can go to our own structure, which is about 18 nanometers across. I'm not sure how that does help, actually. I don't know whether I've got anything else to bring to bear that says whether 8 nanometer separation is a realistic expectation of how close you would have the receptors. Well, and the truth is, once you start getting up to those distances, the flexible peg dimers are not the best way to start using them to define it, because it's 8 plus, and that might be 20 because of the stretching and the dispersed nature of the peg. It just gets to be much more of a problem the longer the peg linkage is. So yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. We're making a gold-labeled IP3 now. Yeah, we've done that, and we're just trying to do the EM now. What we'd really hope to do is, of course, be able to put an antagonist on it as well, and see whether you can tether IP3 and then make sure the other sites can't ever see IP3. But that's quite tricky.
Can you put a branch off from that position to have full
We've certainly had adenophosphine analogs like that that are tetrameric. The difficulty with that is that it's so more constraining about what you really need to get the spacings right, because now the whole thing has just got to almost dock like a job lot onto the IP3 receptor. You can't have flexibility anywhere. So the difficulty is, what do you use to be inactive? You know, there isn't any decent high affinity antagonist. That's the problem. You know, we thought about docking some of the channel blockers onto it, which would A, give us a molecular caliper to the separation of the IP3 binding site and a point where a channel blocker would dock, but they're not very good either.
Yeah, I was just about to ask what kind of antagonist you're thinking of.
Well, originally we were thinking of just trying to put big, clumsy, obstructing groups on the end, because there isn't a decent antagonist beyond a channel blocker, but then they're not too hot either.
Yeah. I mean, that's my problem as well. It's a very good, you've got good agonist of the channel, but trying to block it is much more of a problem.
Sure. How do we want, did we want, sorry?
And once you on this slide before, can you say a little bit more?
Sorry, is it the one, this one?
The structure, so what is this type of bullet charge?
We know from all sorts of work that most of the structure of the channel resides within the cytosol. There's pretty good evidence that there are 6 membrane spanning regions which would fit within this bit of the density, and that's about right. It's a little bit big, actually, from our density map to accommodate 24 membrane spanning domains. This bit would be the lumen of the ER, and very, very little of the IP3 receptor projects into the lumen of the ER. So here's the cytosol out here.
Are those receptors actually fixed?
Sorry?
Are these receptors movable?
You mean in this set, in the EM? No, they're fixed on an EM grid, so that they can't move.
In the EM, but in the membrane of the ER, they aren't mobile.
Well, and maybe Lou wants to say more about that.
Yeah, they are mobile.
On the membrane?
And that's our experience too. We've both done FRAP analyses of this fluorescence recovery after photobleaching analyses of IP3 receptors, and they seem to be very mobile. Pardon?
It's pretty uncorrelated.
Yeah, which is surprising given that.
So is there a relation between the size of these and masses and the immersion coefficient? I mean, how fast it is used must have to do with how big they are.
That's right. Maybe Lou wants to. There's a question about diffusion coefficient of the IP3 receptor.
Well, we expressed, and Colin has as well, that proteins of different sizes, either parts of the IP3 receptor are completely unrelated, or just single front membrane proteins with a GFP tag, and we seem to see similar mobilities of all of these proteins. And so we're trying to resolve the differences at the moment, whether there is a size constraint or not.
Okay.
What's the number?
I'm not convinced that our data is readily, that we've collected in a way that we feel comfortable putting a diffusion coefficient to it. Our interest had been rather different from Lou's. We were interested in what it was that targeted IP3 receptors, so we've been expressing fragments of them and trying to compare rates of diffusion. But nonetheless, we were all surprised to find just how freely mobile, and that's your experience as well. Yeah.
In our case, the calculation is a little bit diverse. It seems to depend on how well we batch your cells. So, but as far as we can tell, you know, I mean, there's not much of a constraint.
Right.
It's all over the place very easily.
And this has been a real surprise, given particularly in Lou and I guess your data, where there's a stability as to which points of the cell seem to show up as hotspots responding to IP3, and yet,
So.
Yeah, and yet the next observation tells you the IP3 receptors are wandering all over the place. So we're flummoxed as to how to make sense. And in fact, Lou's done it in the same cells. They've made the FRAP measurements and the stability. I don't want to steal your latest talk. So we're all puzzled by it, I think. What do we want to do then? I could stop there if you wish.
No, not stop. But I think we should have a break. Let's say 10 minutes.
Coffee in the coffee room
for everybody. That's a nice way to.
It is very interesting. You would be very interested in the model that I'm going to propose on the next tomorrow's talk. This kind of scheme.
Right.
In the model.
Okay.
It's really amazing.
This is okay. You're going to talk about it tomorrow. Oh, yeah. Great. Well, that's yeah.
But one thing I probably have missed. You mentioned that the lag time is not shortened with the pre-incubation with the IP3 when you... Is the calcium content of the pre-incubation high calcium?
No, it's not. Obviously, we can't do it with very high calcium because that inhibits it.
Right.
So we could only do it up to about 700 nanomolar calcium.
That shortens the lag time.
It shortens it, but it doesn't get shorter by virtue of pre-incubation. So it doesn't matter whether you deliver the calcium at the same time as the IP3 or whether you pre-incubate for 30 seconds or a couple of minutes.
Right.
The latency is still the same. You don't seem to derive any benefit from seeing the calcium before the IP3.
But then, okay.
That was our observation.
I see. With pre-incubation with calcium.
With the calcium.
If you pre-incubate, yeah. So I was just getting mixed up. So if you... there's no pre-incubation of IP3 in your experiment.
No,
yeah, as long as
no,
the IP3 goes in, that's the starting.
Yeah,
point.
We've got no way then of stopping the channel inexorably moving towards its opening. We've never, you know, it doesn't matter how much BAPTA we put in, we can't stop it opening.
Yeah,
which
the other interesting thing is that in our experiment, we've concerned about the BAPTA effect, so we've looked at these various concentrations of BAPTA, never very high. So
yeah.
I think 1 millimolar of BAPTA is probably so. Most that we've tried, haven't seen any significant change. Maybe it's just too low to change the effect.
Yeah, you mean the dose response curve, yeah.
Right.
It's only the free BAPTA that does it.
So if
you're setting the free calcium,
yeah.
I can't remember exactly what we measured as the IC50. It was several hundred micromolar, but I can't remember exactly what it is. So you're probably right in where...
Yeah, we stick to 500 micromolar total BAPTA.
Half of which is bound to calcium anyway.
Right. Yeah,
so you've probably got a couple of hundred micromolar free, so you may just miss it.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, we were consciously, you know... not trying to go too high in the concentration precisely because of the possibility of that. And we don't want to look at BAPTA effect.
Well, the trouble with that is you then got problems of worrying about BAPTA dissociation from the IP3 receptor being rate limiting for IP3 binding.
Yeah, so we prefer not to venture into that area. We have been, in my experiment, you know, I can isolate the nucleus and go back to the same area, and the PD, the detection rate of the hydrogen receptor is really phenomenal.
And is that where you've done your FRAP as well?
No, not in the oocyte system. It's it's CHO cell.
Okay.
But I was surprised, and we don't have a very good explanation of how fast these things
are. We did it just on the basis that this is bound to diffuse slowly because we were doing targeting work as to what puts it in the ER.
Mm-hmm.
So as a kind of little filler to work, we just went in doing the full length, knowing it would be immobile. So let's see which bits of the protein are responsible for the immobility. And then the first thing we did was that the full length was just whizzing around like nobody's business.
Bleaching.
And then recovery. And then
you didn't want to put a D on it, but sort of roughly.
I can't put a D on. I can tell you what the half time for recovery on a bleach of about 5 microns across is of the order of 15 or 20 seconds. And I think that's about the same for Lou.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have the exact number. The only thing that I know.
Five micron across. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
we can track where the puff sites are. Yeah, within half a micron or better.
Yeah, it's
20-30 minutes.
Yeah, it's. It was completely unexpected. In some ways, Lou's data is more powerful because they've done it in the very cells where they've kept stimulating with low concentrations of agonist and find the same hotspots coming up.
Yeah, we haven't. Yeah.
So they've got data. You know, effectively your data and ours, but in one cell type, that they have a stability of hotspots, but not net anything like the resolution, I guess, that you're at. You should talk to Lou about it. Yeah, I don't want to sort of
steal his hotspots, but the diffusion of
doesn't make sense.
So the receptors are drifting in, and something turns them on.
That is possible. Yes.
Just here, and then they drift away, and they turn off again.
But then, why should it light up the same way next time? I don't. How would that work?
One thing is there's something anchored which isn't the IP3 receptors.
But then it has to interact with the IP3.
Which has to interact
I see.
And then yet still let it go, as easy as...
So then what you're saying is that an IP3 receptor can respond only if it's found this partner, which is immobile. So gosh, that would be...
But when it finds the partner,
it can't enter the building before 8 or after 5.
I doubt whether I'll need it, actually. If you've got spare ones at the end, but I doubt whether I'll need it. There may be people who really want one.
We've got enough.
Okay.
I think you can have one.
Okay, I'll just go and grab a drink while we're...
I have one very simple question.
Sure.
If the sequential scheme for the activation holds, that you need IP3 before calcium can bind to an activating site, then when you make a steady state measurement of calcium binding, do you see differences whether IP3 is there or not?
You've got no way of measuring calcium binding.
There's no.
You've got the radio label, but for all sorts of technical reasons, which are to do with the amount you need to have there and the specific activity and the other calcium binding, you cannot measure the calcium binding. It'd be great if you could, but you're stuffed on that one. No, I wish we could do that. The fact that there's no inhibition over that whole couple of seconds is what's really surprising, because the off rate for IP3 is about, the channel closure is about 200 millisecond half time when you wash IP3 away.
Mm-hmm. So that gives an upper bound on what IP3 should take to dissociate.
Well, it's probably a lower bound, actually, because if you need 4 IP3 bound to open the channel and only one has to come off to close it,
right.
Then the IP3 dissociation rate will actually be much slower than the channel closure rate. But nonetheless, it still means either that under the conditions we've engineered there, calcium can't jump in the time that the IP3 has dissociated and it reassociates before the inhibitory calcium has a chance to get in, or else that multiple bindings of IP3 protect the whole IP3 receptor. And I don't know which of those it is.
Right, for example, one or the other. I mean, what is the idea? what the binding actually does. I mean, do people think in terms, I haven't followed the channel literature in molecular terms very much, that there's some allosteric effect or direct modulation of a calcium pore if the IP3 binds?
We still don't have enough structural information to know. I mean, we know sort of more global things like that the N and the C termini of the protein seem to talk to each other. IP3 binding sites out of the N terminal, channels out of the C terminal, and there seems to be some physical association.
Some kind of also allosteric effect, or in a way that IP3 binds in some place and then the channel is modified
elsewhere.
So the protein sort of talks through this, or
we just don't know.
We've looked at the YFP, which has got a tethered to the membrane of the cells, and we found a different domain of another protein. And we don't see a huge difference between the.
How long do you want me? I mean, I really don't want to talk over my time. I'm happy to talk, but I don't. It's a nice way of dealing it, having people just put in all the time.
Yeah. You know, that's how it is.
The next stuff is much more biological, you know, much less probably appealing to.
You know, saturate people earlier.
Yeah. Well, exactly how it was supposed to be, so that's fine.
Okay.
That's why we got so much time.
Shall I kick off again? Okay.
Actually, there was. I saw a report back in last year's article.
I think we're going to start again. Wish I move on to the second source of calcium now and look at how calcium might enter the cells across the plasma membrane. And I guess the ideas that have proven most popular for the last few years in this area is this idea that Jim Putney put forward, where when you make IP3 and it does all the things I've just talked about, leading to the emptying of the intracellular calcium stores, that somehow those intracellular calcium stores deliver a signal to a channel in the plasma membrane, so-called capacitative calcium entry channel or a store-regulated calcium entry channel, that leads to its opening. The key point is that the stimulus for this opening of this channel is the empty store itself, however you bring about its emptying. That's the idea. And people have thought this is the major route for calcium entry evoked by all these receptors, and they sort of get agitated about what it is that might code the channel. There's all sorts of ideas about which proteins it may be that encode that channel, all sorts of ideas about what the signal may be that passes from the empty store to this capacitative calcium entry channel. I don't want to get into any of that today. But the other issue is really whether this is the most important channel or whether other channels, there clearly are other channels, calcium channels that are regulated by these receptors, as to whether other channels also play their part in generating the calcium entry signals that most of these receptors bring about in addition to their bringing about the calcium signal through the emptying of the intracellular calcium stores. And what I'd like to persuade you of in this second part of my talk, that really it's perhaps not even a sensible question to ask whether this is more important form of calcium entry, as so-called CCE, for capacitative calcium entry. It's perhaps not a sensible question to ask whether that's more important than this non-capacitative calcium entry, because I'll suggest that really these channels may deliver calcium to the cell in different ways so as to fulfill different jobs, so that it's no more sensible to ask whether one's more important than the other than it is to ask whether your arm or your leg is more important. They each have a different job to do, and that's really what I want to try and convince you of in this second part of my talk. So here are the punchlines. I'll show you that in this cell line that we work with, which is a A7R5 vascular smooth muscle cell line, that there are two calcium entry pathways regulated by the two limbs of the phosphoinositide pathway. There is a capacitative pathway which indirectly is regulated by IP3 because, of course, it's IP3 that empties the stores. But then there's another non-capacitative pathway that's regulated by a consequence of the diacylglycerol that's always produced when you make the IP3. I'll show you that although these are two separate calcium entry pathways, they're plainly two separate channels, that the two are regulated together. In fact, they're regulated in opposing fashions so that when one opens, the other closes and vice versa. And I'll show you that that leads to, in the physiological setting, to a strictly sequential activation of these channels. So that the first channel to open when you give the agonist is this non-capacitative pathway, and then this capacitative channel opens only when you remove the agonist. I'll show that it's not actually diacylglycerol itself that regulates this channel, but it's diacylglycerol being metabolized to arachidonic acid and then regulating nitric oxide synthase that leads to this reciprocal regulation of the two pathways, the activation of this one, the inhibition of that one. And then in the very last bit, I'll show you that that pattern of regulation is actually different for different receptors. So the different receptors that couple to phospholipase C, and so make these two messengers, actually bring different calcium entry pathways into play. Okay, well, this is just to sort of make you aware of the tools that we have to deal with in looking at these two calcium entry paths, because they become quite important for later. So the background is that in lots of earlier work, we'd shown that vasopressin, when it stimulates its receptor, activates phospholipase C, makes diacylglycerol, and arachidonic acid is produced from diacylglycerol by this enzyme DAG lipase. And we have a selective inhibitor of that enzyme, just as we have a selective, though pretty dirty, inhibitor of phospholipase C. And it's the arachidonate then that's required to go on and activate this non-capacitative pathway. We can show that because if we block either of these steps, we block the activation of that pathway. And if we add arachidonate or a non-metabolizable analog of arachidonate, we can activate this channel as well. So that was the starting point. The two channels differ in their permeability to cations, so that strontium goes through this one, but not this. Manganese goes through this, but not this one. And calcium and barium go through both of them. And we also have selective blockers of the two channels. The gadolinium at 1 micromolar will irreversibly block this channel, and 2-APB, which many people use as an antagonist of the IP3 receptor, also selectively blocks the capacitative calcium entry pathway. And we have two pharmaceutical compounds, LOE and SKF, which also selectively block this channel and not the other one. And a high concentration of gadolinium will block both pathways. So that's the tools that we've got to play with, basically. And this just shows you that those inhibitors really do work. Here's the sort of procedure that we use to make the measurements. These are all FURA2 loaded cells, so we're loading the cells with a fluorescent calcium indicator, and then we're monitoring the changes in cytosolic calcium concentration. And what we've done in these cells here is to use thapsigargin, which is an irreversible inhibitor of the calcium pump of the ER, to selectively empty the intracellular calcium stores and so deliver the stimulus, pharmacologically deliver the stimulus that leads to the activation of capacitative calcium entry. So that now when we restore extracellular calcium, we get a big capacitative calcium entry signal. And as you see, if we then give gadolinium 1 micromolar, we block that signal. Now when we restore the calcium, we get nothing. When we give vasopressin, we get our small non-capacitative calcium entry pathway. And that's just summarized up here. Here's the capacitative pathway blocked by 1 micromolar gadolinium, the non-capacitative not affected by 1 micromolar gadolinium. And then turning to the other pathway, same sort of protocol. Here's thapsigargin to empty the stores. And now we come in with this compound LOE908, which is going to, as I'll show you, a selective blocker of the second of the pathways. And there's our capacitative entry going on perfectly normally, just like it did up there. And now we put in gadolinium to block with a capacitative pathway, we know that's selective from up there. Now if we give vasopressin, we don't get our non-capacitative calcium entry, and basically that's all summarized here. The punchline just being that LOE selectively blocks the non-capacitative pathway, gadolinium selectively blocks the capacitative pathway. The tools become really quite important later. And that's just summarized here. Here's our non-capacitative pathway activated, as I've shown you, by arachidonic acid and blocked by LOE. Here's the capacitative pathway activated, as I've shown you, by empty stores and blocked by low concentrations of gadolinium. Now, I'd like you just to focus over here, though, at the relative amplitudes of these two maximally activated calcium entry signals. The capacitative signal being some 4 or 5 times larger than the calcium entry signal deriving from activation of this non-capacitative pathway. And yet we and others have consistently argued that this might actually be the pathway that's mediating most of the calcium entry during agonist stimulation, which on the face of it seems a pretty perverse kind of thing to be saying when it's manifestly the smaller of the calcium entry signals. And the reason for that, as I'll show you, is that whenever you activate these pathways physiologically, you will deliver a very potent inhibition of this pathway, such that this one does come to predominate. So that's the theme for the next part of the talk, really. Now, we can look at that by taking advantage of the fact that this capacitative pathway allows manganese to pass through it, where the non-capacitative pathway doesn't. And manganese has the unusual property of quenching FURA2 fluorescence rather than giving the normal sort of reciprocal changes in fluorescence at two wavelengths that you get with calcium. So we can load cells with FURA2 and then measure, as we've done here, the quenching of the fluorescence when we add extracellular manganese and it flows into the cell to bind to the FURA2. So here's the empty stores, and we see this enhanced rate of manganese entry reflected in the quench of the FURA2. But now if we give vasopressin, you see that quenching is much inhibited. But if we give vasopressin now in the presence of either U7, this drug that blocks the phospholipase C, from which the IP3 and the diacylglycerol are the formation of which is catalyzed, or if we give RHC, the inhibitor of the diglipase, which releases the arachidonate from the diacylglycerol, then both block the effect of vasopressin to cause that inhibition of the capacitative calcium entry pathway. I don't know what it's due to, because we've had problems with it in the past and not on other occasions, and I'm puzzled by it. It's a horrible compound.
Because when we found that if you add B7B1B2 prior to
the
calcium entry, then it's entry long, it's
infinity.
Right. But it's just such a dirty compound.
I know.
You worry about any data rising, just be effect of PI
Well, this is not going on before the Thapsigargon. I'd say if there is an order of addition phenomenon, then this could be one further consequence of it. But yeah, so the Thapsigargon has gone in ages before, and then you add the manganese and record the quench. No, we've had inhibition of CCE as well, looking like channel block or something in the past. And I've never read back, and we've just been annoyed by this drug. I've never been back systematically to take apart whether it could have been an order of addition phenomenon. That's just summarized down here. Here's our normal manganese entry. Vasopressin blocks it. It blocks it also if you replace all the permium monovalent cations with NMDG. Now we did that so as to stop vasopressin causing depolarization through a non-selective cation channel, and thereby just decreasing the driving force for manganese entry. And as you see, it's blocked if we inhibit phospholipase C, blocked if we inhibit DAG lipase, and also there's no effect of vasopressin. If we look at its effects in a similar sort of assay in a variant of this cell line that we have that seems to lack this enzyme DAG lipase. So the take home from that is that, as we'd said earlier, arachidonate seemed to be stimulating the non-capacitative pathway. Now we're suggesting that that same arachidonate is going on to inhibit the capacitative pathway. So arachidonate then really becomes the pivot that's governing which of these two calcium entry pathways will be active. And if you like, the direct demonstration of that comes from these experiments, where we're starting with the cells with completely empty stores, and so as to prevent us seeing the capacitative calcium entry, we give gadolinium so we can look cleanly at the non-capacitative pathway. Nothing happens with calcium until we add arachidonate and we get our small non-capacitative calcium entry, and that's mimicked equally by the non-metabolized analogues of arachidonate. Conversely, if we block the non-capacitative pathway with its selective blocker and restore calcium to these cells with empty stores, we get a capacitative calcium entry, and if we give arachidonate on the back of that, we drive that back down. So that's really just the experimental demonstration that arachidonate really does look like it's the point at which you decide whether you're going to inhibit one and stimulate the other pathway. The crux question, of course, is which of these calcium entry pathways mediates the calcium entry when you stimulate the cells with vasopressin? Who does the business? And that's shown in this complicated slide, where we're using now a submaximal concentration of vasopressin to try and come as close as we can do to a physiological stimulation. I'll just go through this fairly slowly. If we just concentrate for the moment on the response that we see when vasopressin is present. And basically we've done four conditions here. We've just got a control condition in black, calcium rising and then giving this sustained plateau. We've got a condition where we've got 1 micromolar gadolinium present to completely block the capacitative calcium entry pathway. We've got a stimulus at the bottom here in green where both pathways are blocked. And there you see all we get is the calcium mobilization, and then the calcium signal comes back down to baseline, as you'd expect. That's just vasopressin releasing the intracellular calcium stores. And then in the middle, in blue, we've got LOE908, this compound that blocks the non-capacitative pathway. And as you see, let me take a step back and walk you through exactly what's happening. So here's our control response then, calcium mobilization followed by calcium entry. We block both calcium entry pathways and we see only the calcium mobilization and no calcium entry as you'd expect. Block the capacitative pathway and in the presence of the agonist, the stimulus, the response is exactly as it was in the wild type. It doesn't have any effect on the calcium entry signal summarized down at the bottom here, that we've blocked the capacitative pathway. So none of the calcium entry that's giving us that sustained calcium entry signal in the presence of the agonist is coming through the capacitative pathway. Conversely, if we block the non-capacitative pathway, we get no sustained calcium entry while the vasopressin is present. So all of the calcium entry that is occurring in the presence of vasopressin is going through that non-capacitative pathway. Now then, when we remove the vasopressin, with the non-capacitative pathway blocked, we get this rebound capacitative calcium entry. That's perhaps not surprising, because there's been no calcium entry going on here while the vasopressin has been present to allow the stores to refill. But now when we remove the stimulus that's leading to the arachidonate formation, the stores are still empty, but we relieve the inhibition of the capacitative pathway so that now we get a transient capacitative calcium entry and the stores refill and shut it back down again. But I think perhaps the most interesting one is the black, which is the control, because there, of course, we do have a sustained calcium entry. But still, when we remove the agonist, we get this delayed activation of capacitative calcium entry. So that's telling us that even though calcium entry is going on through the non-capacitative pathway, it's insufficient to allow the stores to refill. And when you remove the agonist, you get this transient activation of capacitative calcium entry. And I think that's an important point, because it tells us that while the vasopressin is present, all the calcium entry is going through this non-capacitative pathway. When you remove it, you switch it and get a transient activation of this capacitative calcium entry pathway. I'll come to that at the end. No is the short answer, but we thought yes, and well, I'll come to it at the end.
When you, if you just, if you think you continue the control experiment, would the CCP be able to
We should have, and we haven't done it. Well, we'd expect so, but we haven't done it. So that leads us to this sort of scheme where we start with the two channels inactive, and then we activate the vasopressin receptor with vasopressin, which, amongst other things, leads to the production of arachidonic acid. The IP3 will, of course, have emptied the intracellular calcium stores to give us a calcium release signal, and that one would suppose would have led to activation of capacitative calcium entry, but for the inhibition that is being delivered by the arachidonate. So we see no capacitative calcium entry. Instead, the arachidonic acid stimulates the non-capacitative pathway to give us a calcium entry. Now, there's pretty good evidence from many groups, but Dermot Cooper amongst them, to suggest that different physiological responses may selectively couple to calcium entering cells through different calcium entry pathways. So the argument we'd like to make is that this calcium may perhaps be calcium that selectively is delivered to some cellular processes that may lead to cellular activation. So that then when we remove the vasopressin, the intracellular calcium stores are still empty. We stop making the arachidonate, so of course we've no longer got the means of stimulating the non-capacitative pathway, but the empty stores now can dictate a capacitative calcium entry for as long as it takes to refill the intracellular stores. So now we've switched from non-capacitative to capacitative calcium entry, and we'd like to suggest that perhaps that calcium may be more effectively used to promote cellular recovery. So the argument would be that by this sequential activation of one calcium entry pathway and then another, we may actually have a means of allowing the receptor to actively promote cellular activation through one calcium entry pathway, and then when it comes off its receptor, actively promote cellular recovery by promoting calcium entry through another calcium entry pathway. We have no direct evidence for that. That's simply speculation. So there's the scheme, and the simple scheme as it's shown here plainly implies that this effect of arachidonic acid, this reciprocal effect of arachidonic acid on the two pathways, is a direct effect of arachidonate binding to CCE and the NCCE pathways. Indeed, that was our hypothesis until we came to look at the effects of nitric oxide, which has many effects on cellular calcium homeostasis, which was the provocation for us looking. And what you see here is if we empty the intracellular calcium stores with thapsogargon, we get our normal capacitative calcium entry signal. But if we then deliver nitric oxide, that capacitative calcium entry signal is abolished. We can do the same experiments using an NO donor, this NOC18, which releases NO, and there's the dose response curve to it, complete inhibition of the capacitative calcium entry, and the blue just shows the reversibility of that effect when we wash away the NOC18. And notice that these inhibitors, which do block the effect of vasopressin on the inhibition of CCE, these inhibitors have no effect on the ability of NO to block the inhibition of this capacitative pathway, implying, of course, that the NO lies downstream of these earlier steps in the signaling pathway in its effects on inhibiting the capacitative pathway. And just to complete this element of the story, we've looked to see whether these cells express the enzymes that are responsible for NO formation, these NOS enzymes, and as you see, they express NOS3 or endothelial NOS, and as we'd expect of endothelial NOS, it's associated with the membranes of the cells. So the message from that then is that NO, nitric oxide, can block capacitative calcium entry in these cells. question is whether that's the way in which the receptor brings about its inhibition of capacitative calcium entry. And to do that, we've taken advantage of some inhibitors of nitric oxide synthase, which is L-NAME, which is an analog of L-arginine, the natural substrate from which the NO is made, such that the two compete with each other for the enzyme, and L-NAME can thereby prevent the formation of NO. So here's our normal capacitative calcium entry. Stores were emptied out here. We restore the calcium, get a nice big calcium entry signal. We give vasopressin now, and that's abolished despite restoring the calcium. And now with vasopressin still present, if we give L-NAME, the blocker of NOS, then now the vasopressin is no longer capable of that inhibition. And now it's really getting complicated now. Now if we give L-arginine to surmount the antagonism imposed by the L-NAME, then now the vasopressin again becomes capable of inhibiting. Is that okay? And that's just summarized down here. Here's our controlled capacitative calcium entry. It's abolished by vasopressin. The inhibitor of NO prevents vasopressin from bringing about that inhibition. And if you like, the inhibitor of the inhibitor reverses that effect so that vasopressin is once again capable of inhibiting the capacitative pathway. Well, one of the targets of nitric oxide, one of the important targets of nitric oxide in cells is a soluble guanylyl cyclase from which cyclic GMP is made, which can then of course go on to activate cyclic GMP dependent protein kinase or PKG. So we wanted to assess whether that was the means whereby vasopressin was working to inhibit this pathway, and sure enough 8-bromocyclic GMP mimics the effect of vasopressin in that if we treat with 8-bromocyclic GMP we can block the capacitative calcium entry. But perhaps more importantly, here's our capacitative calcium entry again. If we block the soluble guanylyl cyclase here with ODQ, then vasopressin is no longer capable of inhibiting the capacitative calcium entry. And if we block the protein kinase here with this enzyme KT, again, vasopressin can no longer block the capacitative calcium entry pathway. So it's looking then that the whole of this sequence is required for vasopressin out here through to protein kinase G to bring about this inhibition of the capacitative calcium entry pathway. So we end up with this sort of dual regulation of capacitative calcium entry looking something like this, with the vasopressin receptor out here stimulating phospholipase C to give us the two initial intracellular messengers, IP3 and diacylglycerol. And then IP3, without much further amplification really, coming through to the IP3 receptor to bring about activation of the capacitative calcium entry pathway. But then there's this great amplifying cascade of events that pass through these this biochemical pathways through arachidonate to NOS3 and so on, through to protein kinase G to bring about the inhibition of CCE. And the argument I'd like to make is that these amplifying cascades are obviously a way of increasing your sensitivity to the initial stimulus, such that it's likely that one imposes this powerfully amplifying cascade to inhibit the capacitative pathway ahead of being able to get it activated by the empty stores, so that one would never get, in the presence of vasopressin, a capacitative calcium entry signal, because you'd always deliver this powerful inhibition to the pathway. We would think it's arachidonate directly. In earlier experiments, we blocked the metabolism of arachidonate and certainly not prevented its effects, and in one case, with one of the inhibitors, potentiated the effects of vasopressin and with ETYA, we get ETYA mimics the vasopressin. Mimics vasopressin or arachidonate. And ETYA is a non-metabolized analog of arachidonate. So turning now then to the non-capacitative pathway, so we've seen that for this store regulated or capacitative calcium entry, vasopressin goes through arachidonate, through NOS, all the way through to protein kinase G, and thereby inhibits the channel. So we're coming back now to the non-capacitative pathway, which we know also to depend upon arachidonate, and looking to see what NO does to it. Well, again, the NO mimics and brings about the activation of the pathway. Here's NO, here's the NO donor. And likewise, if we give ETYA, the stable analog of arachidonate, then we can activate this non-capacitative pathway, but we can't do it if we block the NOS, and we can reverse the blockade of the NOS by giving L-arginine and get our non-capacitative calcium entry back again. So again, NO is required for, or NO rather, is capable of activating the non-capacitative pathway. There's the summary data, NO and NOC18 giving us similar activation. Here's ETYA giving us comparable activation to the NO, inhibited by L-name, and then the L-name block reversed by the L-arginine. And although I haven't shown the data, here's the summary for vasopressin. Again, there's vasopressin stimulating the pathway. It's blocked by L-name, and the L-name block is then counteracted by the L-arginine. So that leaves us with this scheme for the non-capacitative pathway. Here's the sequence we've talked through to arachidonate. That has to activate the NOS, leading to NO, and that's giving us activation of the non-capacitative pathway. Now, I showed you earlier that NO then went on to activate soluble guanylyl cyclase to bring about activation, to bring about inhibition of the capacitative pathway. But that turns out not to be the case for the activation of the non-capacitative pathway. So here we're looking at it in isolation, 8-bromocyclic GMP at concentrations that would easily be sufficient to inhibit capacitative calcium entry don't activate the pathway. ODQ, the inhibitor of soluble guanylyl cyclase at a concentration more than sufficient to prevent the effects of vasopressin on the CCE, don't affect the ability of vasopressin to activate this second calcium entry pathway. And likewise with the inhibitor of PKG, a concentration more than sufficient to block the effects of vasopressin on capacitative calcium entry, don't affect it, its effects on this non-capacitative pathway. And again, that's just summarized here. Here's the vasopressin response, unaffected by the two inhibitors and not mimicked by the 8-bromocyclic GMP. So here's the scheme then. We're activating the vasopressin receptor, making the two messengers. The IP3 is emptying the stores and would thereby, one suppose, deliver the required stimulus to the capacitative pathway that should have led to its activation, but for the fact that the diacylglycerol is metabolized to arachidonate, which somehow is activating NOS, the NO is thereby leading to the activation of this non-capacitative calcium entry pathway. And we take a signal from further down this sequence through activation of the guanylyl cyclase and the protein kinase G that inhibits the capacitative calcium entry pathway. And it's that that leads us to this sequential activation of first the non-capacitative calcium entry pathway when the vasopressin is present, and the active inhibition of the capacitative pathway, and then when we remove the vasopressin, the non-capacitative pathway closes and we relieve the active suppression of the capacitative to give us this transient capacitative calcium entry. So all that I've said so far, and this comes back to a point that was raised earlier, all that I've implied so far suggests that the mere provision of diacylglycerol is sufficient to ensure that it's the rate-limiting step for providing the arachidonic acid from which all else flows. And of course, an expectation from that would be that any receptor that stimulates phospholipase C is going to show the same behavior as we've seen with vasopressin. And that proves not to be the case. So we stimulated these same cells. Let me just show you the vasopressin data first. Here's the sort of data we've come to expect with a maximal or a submaximal concentration of vasopressin. The story is the same. Here's the stimulus, just looking at the submaximal. You can see that all of the calcium entry that we're getting here is immune to the effects of gadolinium, which, remember, blocks the capacitative pathway, but fully blocked by SKF, which, remember, blocks the non-capacitative pathway. That's consistent with everything I've told you so far, that the only calcium entry that's active when the vasopressin is present is the non-capacitative pathway. But we can come along now with another receptor that's expressed in these A7R5 cells, and which also couples to phospholipase C, and that's the 5-HT receptor, and get exactly the opposite story. So here's the 5-HT, note a maximal and a submaximal concentrations, and two things to notice. Firstly, that the calcium entry signals are much bigger, although the initial phases are similar for the two stimuli. And secondly, that SKF, the blocker of the non-capacitative pathway, has no effect on that calcium entry, and gadolinium blocks it. And that's the same at both agonist concentrations. So, I'm sorry? These are the same cell. These are interleaved cells in the measurements. So the same day, we interleave cover slips as to whether they'll go one way or the other with the agonist. So, I mean, in that sense, they're different cover slips, but they're as closely controlled as we can make them. And that's just summarized here, where the black symbols just denote the calcium mobilization response, which we take to be some index of how much IP3 you're making, the initial calcium mobilization phase. So here's a maximal and a concentrations of vasopressin here, 5-HT here, submaximal concentrations here. And I think perhaps the most important point to focus in is, look, even if we titrate down to submaximal concentrations of each stimulus, so that neither is delivering, can possibly be delivering a supramaximal stimulus, if you will. We would argue we've titrated them to this comparable level of activation of phospholipase C. Yet, under these conditions, we get much more calcium entry with 5-HT than we do with the vasopressin. And not only much more, but they're going through entirely different pathways. They're going through the non-capacitative pathway in response to vasopressin, and through the capacitative pathway in response to 5-HT. Now, because of all the evidence that I'd shown you earlier implicating NO in the way in which vasopressin regulates these calcium entry pathways, we've recently started measuring cyclic GMP formation in response to these different stimuli. And this just shows the response to vasopressin. Here in the presence of extracellular calcium and here in its absence, the difference is perhaps not surprising because the endothelial NOS that I've mentioned to you is also regulated by calcium. But the important point is that we do get a stimulation of cyclic GMP formation by vasopressin in the complete absence of extracellular calcium. And as I'll show in a moment, under conditions where the vasopressin cannot generate a cytosolic calcium signal, so completely empty stores and no extracellular calcium present. And arachidonate also will stimulate cyclic GMP formation. I won't say any more about that. But this is perhaps the more important characterization of the effects of vasopressin. Here's a maximal and a submaximal concentration of vasopressin, and here the pharmacology, all of which is consistent with the pathway that I've described to you so far. So that the effects of vasopressin on cyclic GMP formation, all of these assays now done under conditions where the vasopressin cannot generate a calcium signal. So the stores are empty and there's no extracellular calcium present. So the formation is blocked. Let me just get my bearings. So here's the inhibitor of phospholipase C, being reducing it back to basal. The inactive analog does not. The DAG lipase inhibitor out here blocks the cyclic GMP formation. It's blocked, as we'd expect, by L-MAME, which is the inhibitor of nitric oxide synthase. That block is reversed by arginine, and again, as we'd expect, it's blocked by the soluble guanylyl cyclase inhibitor. So we're suggesting then there is a route from the vasopressin through some calcium-independent route through this sequence of events to the activation of NOS and the cyclic GMP formation. Here's that similar sort of data over again. Here's the control cyclic GMP levels, and here the responses to vasopressin, maximal and submaximal concentrations of vasopressin, and here the responses to 5-HT. And you see, it's easier if we compare it alongside the calcium, where we've got the calcium measurements that we'd made earlier in response to these two stimuli, that if, for example, we compare 30 nanomolar vasopressin, the submaximal concentration of vasopressin, which is giving us a comparable amount of calcium release to the 100 nanomolar some maximal stimulation with 5-HT, then the vasopressin is giving a cyclic GMP formation, the 5-HT is not. Even though they've activated, one would suppose, by virtue of the comparable calcium mobilization signals, activated phospholipase C to the same extent. So we're suggesting then that whatever this route is that takes you through from vasopressin receptor to activation of NOS, the vasopressin receptor can do it, but the 5-HT receptor can't. So it can't simply be their shared ability to activate phospholipase C.
Could you briefly sketch again and a little bit of NOS now? So what's the relevance of cyclic GMP?
Cyclic GMP is a maybe if I could, is it perhaps easier from here? It's quite difficult to measure NO directly. And so cyclic GMP we are really using as a surrogate record for our purposes of the activity of nitric oxide synthase. And because it's blocked by this inhibitor, selectively blocked by this inhibitor of the soluble guanylyl cyclase, which is the enzyme that's activated by NO, we believe it to be a reasonable reporter of how well the two pathways have activated the NO synthase. So that brings me to this final slide, where we have these two receptors in the A7R5 cell line, both of them activating phospholipase C through their G protein to produce IP3 and diacylglycerol. The IP3, of course, going off to release calcium from intracellular stores. And then one would suppose the empty stores would be activating CCE, the capacitative calcium entry pathway. And that's exactly what happens for 5-HT, but the vasopressin receptor seems to deliver an additional stimulus so as to activate the cleavage of arachidonic acid, would be the simplest explanation, from diacylglycerol to bring into train this additional sequence of events, arachidonic acid release stimulating NO formation, which then directly activates the non-capacitative pathway, and from these further downstream events, leads to the inhibition of the capacitative calcium entry pathway. So here then are two stimuli, both ostensibly using the same initial parts of the signaling path with a phospholipase C, nonetheless delivering to the cell activation of a different pattern of activation of calcium entry pathways. For vasopressin, first the non-capacitative pathway, and then when you remove the stimulus, then capacitative calcium entry becomes important, whereas for the 5-HT stimulus, we get only the capacitative calcium entry. Yeah, we've certainly used isotetrandrin, which blocks, for example, Trevor Shuttleworth's activation of IARC in his cells, has no effect in ours. And conversely, the RHC in his hands does not block his does not block his activation of IARC, this current that in his hands seems to be activated directly by arachidonate. So I think that the biochemistry of how one gets to the arachidonic acid seems to be different in the two cells.
Are you seeing in which point from the diacylglycerol all the way down to PKG is 5-HT not capable of
Yeah, our guess is here, but we're not yet certain of that. That it's promoting the release of arachidonate, because just delivering arachidonate to the cells is capable of bringing all else into play without needing to have receptor activation. But we don't know that for sure yet. We haven't looked. Sure. Yeah, we haven't looked. The 5-HT stuff's very recent, and we just haven't followed that up yet.
Calcium signals when
it's different. We haven't looked. I mean, people seem to run into all sorts of problems with the pH domain, so we haven't done that, no. No, plainly, it's not a watertight argument to argue that because the calcium mobilization signals are the same, that that's indicative of phospholipase C activity being the same. It's the best we can do at the moment from this.
Yeah.
We don't know. We don't know. It's rapidly activated and rapidly reversed, so I guess no particular reason to invoke insertion into the membrane. But we don't know whether the channel itself is phosphorylated or other proteins that may yet intervene between the phosphorylation event and the channel. We just don't know. We don't, of course, know what the channel is, so it's kind of difficult to look at that directly.
Do these cells oscillate at sustained submaximal?
They're quite different. We've not looked at it very hard. Others have done a little bit on it. They give very nice membrane-driven oscillators, which is I should have said at the outset that these do have L-type calcium channels, which we blocked through all of these analyses just so that we weren't polluted by them. But you can get really nice membrane potential-driven oscillations that are entirely unstable membrane potential driving periodic opening of the L-type calcium channels, and that can be quite robust. But if you block the L-type and then look for your more sort of intracellular-driven oscillator, it's much more difficult to see them. We've not really had much success with it, and people that have published on it, it's not been wonderful either. So no is probably the short answer, or it's difficult. I'm not going to mention that. What's that? And I'll just leave that up to finish with. I acknowledge the people that have done the work in my lab. You can read it for yourself.